This class is the second in a series on healing broken relationships. We have entitled today's session, Great Expectation and Other Myths. Today we want to focus in on how expectations and irrational thinking contribute to problems in relationships between people. Just a reminder, we are talking about all relationships, including friendships, family relationships, and couple relationships. Because we tend to work primarily or see a lot of couples in our work, you may hear a heavier emphasis on that aspect, but our intention is to be inclusive of all relationships rather than exclusive of some. Joe is going to begin today by discussing some of the ways expectations create problems in relationships. And after that, we will be talking together about some of the ways in which irrational thinking complicates and gets in the way of our relationships. Joe?
Wanted to, before we do that too, just remind you that we do have a few bibliography selected bibliography sheets here. Several of the David Augsburger books, Caring Enough to Confront, Caring Enough to Forgive When Caring is Not Enough. A particularly good book by Harold Bloomfield, we think. Secular book, but a very good one, Making Peace with Your Parents. We'll have more to say about that book and some of the ideas in that book in the next couple of presentations. And then a couple of others here that you might be interested in looking at. Ruth Carter Stapleton, the original or early person around healing of memories, and of course the sister of Jimmy Carter, The Gift of Inner Healing, published back in 76, and a couple of others that you might be interested in. So you can pick those up after. Expectations. I want to talk a little bit about those today in relationships. Expectations can create some problems. I like to say that there are two kinds of conflict that people can have. One of the kinds of conflict is unavoidable, and the other is avoidable. And we want to dispatch quickly with the unavoidable conflicts because those are probably things that we don't have a lot of control over. We can certainly learn good ways of handling unavoidable conflicts, but an example of unavoidable conflict would be a little bit like our experience last week in the village when we came, where we lived in a chalet, the three of us, Pat and I and Leslie, lived in a chalet with four other people downstairs and one bathroom. So seven people in one house with one bathroom. That's an unavoidable conflict. You know, there are always going to be times when two people with a need can't satisfy it at the same time, and so somebody has to wait or somebody has to take care of their need very quickly so that other people can also have an opportunity to take care of their need. It's a little bit difficult to think about what it must have been like, I guess, back in the days when plumbing was outdoors. Now, I grew up in a situation where my claim to fame is that I remember not having hot running water. We had to boil all our water, but we did have indoor plumbing. But then we would go down to see my grandparents, and they had outdoor plumbing, and I don't think I went to the bathroom for most of the week that I was at Grandma and Grandpa's. But that's an unavoidable conflict, as we discussed. Then there are avoidable conflicts, and those are based on poor understanding, miscommunication, lack of communication, and expectations that we have for others. I also think that there are two kinds of expectations, and those are expectations that are realistic or unrealistic. And I have a good definition, I think, of realistic and unrealistic expectations. Expectations that are realistic are the ones I have for you. Expectations that are unrealistic are the ones you have for me.
Tells me that all the time.
But I think there are some expectations that are unrealistic that we can look at a little bit more closely. And I think there are basically three or four ways in which expectations and three or four reasons why expectations can be unrealistic. If you listen to me for a while, you'll always have a list. I'm a great list maker. You know, I always think there are three or four things, and people always say, well, is that all there is? Or those aren't the only ones. It's true, there aren't, but there are more. But the ones that I think about are in the following categories. The first is that expectations can be unrealistic when the expectation is for ideal behavior. When we expect ideal behavior, we are unrealistic. Again, it would be nice, it would be convenient, it would be helpful many times if people, especially other people, would operate on an ideal basis, but that is certainly the exception rather than the rule in human behavior, and it may not even be possible. So often we want things to be just right. We want things to be perfect or close to it, even though logic tells us that's not possible. Of course, in relationships, that can create lots of difficulties. We think that perhaps a person should be able to accept objective criticism about their driving or their cooking or their sexual response. But in fact, of course, it's rare that we are objective when we give them that feedback, and it's often very difficult to accept that kind of feedback, especially if one feels threatened or put down. One of the things that we have a little saying around our house called "It needs a little more salt," because I'm a kind of a saltaholic, first of all, and I always go around sampling things and almost always add a little salt to it, and so we kind of we use that as a little bit of a code phrase in our house for it's not quite right, and I fall into the category of those people who often want to just fix things up a little bit more, add a little bit more salt, and so now when we go out and think things aren't just quite right, we'll often say it needs just a little bit more salt. That started when I would add salt to the recipes and Pat would dilute them more with water after I added the salt. So our expectation for ideal behavior gets us into trouble. There's a second way in which expectations can create difficulties, and that's when the expectations are based on, they can become unrealistic when they're based on our need rather than the other person, the other person's need. I think this is especially the case in parent-child relationships. Rather than what's best for the personal growth and development of the other person, we want things to be our way. This just happens, as I said, with parents and kids a great deal. I want to live my life and yours too is often the mistake we make as parents. Some of you know that I'm a baseball fan, and one of the stories that I tell is the story of Jimmy Pearsall. Of course, Jimmy Pearsall told his own story a number of years ago, I think back in the 50s, in a book called Fear Strikes Out. For those of you who are not baseball fans, Jimmy Pearsall was a center fielder for the Boston Red Sox and more recently has been a baseball announcer and still has some contact, I think, in baseball. I think he's a scout or something with the Cubs now. But if you read Jimmy Pearsall's book, or if you saw the movie in which Anthony Perkins starred as Jimmy Pearsall, you know it's a poignant and heart-wrenching story of a young man who grew up under the direction of a father who wanted to be a Major League Baseball player, who could not or was not able to be a Major League Baseball player, and who drove his son, Jimmy Pearsall, to be a Major League Baseball player. And that resulted in Jimmy Pearsall being an excellent baseball player, but at one point in his life, a very disturbed and very unhappy and mentally ill person. And there's one particular scene in the movie that has always struck me, and Jimmy Pearsall writes about it in the book, where he has just joined the Boston Red Sox. And interestingly enough, this is a good example of the conflict and the expectations that were there. Jimmy Pearsall is brought up to the Boston Red Sox, and they don't put him, they have Dom DiMaggio, who was the brother of Joe DiMaggio, and he's playing center field, and they put Jimmy Pearsall in right field. And here he is in his first major league game. He has made it to the majors, and his father is not happy because his father wants him in center field. And in center field is Dom DiMaggio, as I said, one of the, I think, a Hall of Famer and one of the best defensive outfielders that ever played the game. But he is not quite right still. And there's a point at which, I don't know if it's in that first game, but in one of the early games where he hits a home run and his father is at the ballpark. And in the movie, he circles the bases and he crosses home plate and his father is sitting behind home plate. And Jimmy Pearsall just kind of loses it. And he hits the screen, he jumps up on the screen and he shakes the screen, and his father is sitting in horror as Jimmy Pearsall is screaming at him, "Is that good enough for you? Is that good enough for you?" And it's that kind of expectation, of course, in this particular story that created a tremendous amount of difficulty for Jimmy Pearsall growing up. I think it's also the kind of expectation that I'd like to balance off with a little bit of a humorous story out of this book about marriage and the expectations we come to marriage with. This is a book called Marital Myths by Arnold Lazarus. He's written a number of, he's a psychologist, written a number of self-help books. This is a secular book, however, and one that has a number of things in it that Pat and I don't particularly agree with, but it does have this very interesting story. He talks about the fact that maybe what should happen is that people ought to write out job descriptions of their marriage relationship before they marry to get an idea of what the expectations are that are being communicated here. And then he gives an example. He poses a hypothetical situation. John and Mary in their early 20s have been going together for 2 years and are intent on marrying each other. Here is John's job description. "I expect a wife to be a loyal, loving, devoted companion. I want someone who really studies my needs and caters to them. As I see it, a husband should be the center of his wife's universe. Nobody and nothing should come before her husband. One main reason for marrying is to have someone taking care of all my creature comforts. I don't expect to do any cooking, cleaning, shopping, and so forth. I expect a wife to work at remaining sexually attractive, responsive, and desirable. I would want sex at least once a night. I expect my wife to treat my parents and my sister with the same love and respect that I do. As I see it, the duty of a wife is to build up her husband's ego and self-confidence. At the same time, I feel that a man should be the captain of the ship. He should be the boss, and he should be consulted before the wife makes any important decisions." Pat, maybe you would want to read Mary's job description.
Marriage is teamwork, and it consists of two people who are equal partners pulling in the same direction. They should be more ours than his or hers. Married people should function as responsible adults with little mothering or fathering of each other. They should set up their own home and become independent as soon as possible and not lean emotionally on parents or siblings. I would want to be sure that I come first in my husband's eyes. I expect to have help around the house with routine things. We would clean house together, go food shopping together, and operate as a team.
Okay. Give you an example of what that marriage would be like. You know, what do you suppose is going to happen to two people with those kinds of expectations?
Yeah.
The honeymoon would end real quick, wouldn't it?
Or they'd come back quite disillusioned.
That reminds me of a little story, The Honeymoon Is Over, that I have to tell you. When I was Pat and I married when I was an intern in psychology, just starting at the master's level, and they interviewed me for this internship, and three psychologists were in the room, and I had to come in and talk with them, and they were analyzing my appropriateness for internship, and and we had just married about 3 months before, and they said, one of them asked, the chief psychologist there asked, he says, well, he said, is the honeymoon over yet? And I had no idea what he meant. You know, I said, well, we only had a few days to go off, in between semesters. He said, no, that's what I mean. He says, the honeymoon over with yet? And I said, well, I'm not sure what you mean. He says, well, you'll know later. And they just kind of went on to some other areas. But later I understood what he meant. When the honeymoon was over, then I knew. And so, we're all in that situation. The honeymoon ends, and then you have to deal with those set of expectations, some of which we all come with, and many of which are not articulated in relationships. And it's not just marriage, of course. It's in friendships, too. People come with hidden agenda. I need something out of this relationship. If we don't articulate or communicate what those are, those expectations can get us in a lot of trouble. I just want to use one more example here because it sticks in my mind. Maybe you've seen the movie Children of a Lesser God. And in that movie, a very poignant story of a young man who is a teacher of the deaf, and he meets this young woman he falls in love with, but she doesn't talk. All she does is sign. And he wants her to learn to talk. He wants the teacher to learn to talk, and she doesn't want to learn. And their relationship centers around, in the beginning, that situation, and eventually is the breakup, because she wants him to come into her world, which is the world of silence, and he wants her to come into his world, which is the world of communication and talking, verbally talking, not just signing, although he signs quite well. And I think that crystallizes, again, this notion of expectations that we have for one another. We want the other person to be what we want. We want them to be an extension of ourselves so often, rather than to be their own unique person. Take care of me, cook for me, help me, stay home, go to work, whatever it is. I mean, there are all kinds of expectations, but they're often not communicated. Third, the expectation can be unrealistic when it's communicated poorly or inappropriately. The way we talk about our expectations, how we communicate them, can have a great deal to do with whether or not they're accepted or understood. There's a difference between saying, you'd better do it my way or else, and saying, this is what I would like to have. We get into the shoulds and the oughts and the expectations that say, I want you to do it my way. The lecture, the demands, the talks to, rather than the communications with, are often ways in which expectations get distorted and resisted. I talk a lot about the fact, again, in parent-child and family relationships, that if you take a jailer mentality as a parent, what do you get? You get a prisoner's response. What's the prisoner's response? What do prisoners do?
They rebel.
And how do they do it? Well, sometimes they have full-scale riots, but those are fairly rare. What happens more often is that people try to escape. There's surreptitious kind of resistance. There's passive-aggressive behavior. Nothing much gets done. People are in secret relationships and find ways to break out of the system and operate and break down the system. And so expectations poorly communicated are ways in which expectations can be unrealistic. The last way that I wanted to talk about is that expectations can be unrealistic when they reflect a behavior or a capability that goes beyond the ability level or the potential in the other person. There are some things that we expect of other people that they can't do, that they're not capable of doing. Again, I think my best example of this comes out of my own life and in our family. Our oldest daughter, who's now living on her own in Minneapolis and doing quite well, when she was about 10 one day, I was out in the yard working, and she came up and she said, Dad, can I go to the Kennedys for dinner? The neighbors down the street. I said, sure, you can go to Sunday dinner. But I said, we haven't got anything planned. You can go down there. So she went down to dinner, and then she came back later. And as she came back, I looked at her a little bit more closely, and here she had some kind of shorts on and, you know, on top, and she had no, she didn't have any shoes on. Feet were all dirty, and I said to her, I said, you mean to tell me that you went to the Kennedys for dinner, for Sunday dinner, and you had bare feet? You know, what a sin! What a terrible thing for somebody to do. And for some reason, I don't know whether I got tired of working in the yard or whether that's just my person. Yeah, I lost it. I got real angry at her. And I said, well, I said, that is really inappropriate behavior. I said, you go to your room and you stay there till you learn how to act like an adult. Well, unfortunately, Pat heard me say that. The only reason I tell this story is that she heard that, so she would tell it if I didn't tell it. I always like to get it out first. And Laura, you know, in confusion, went to her room, I'm sure. And actually, until about 2 years ago, we were still sliding their meals under the door. But Pat just kind of shook her head and said, did you hear what you said to her? So, you know, those kinds of expectations, when we're asking somebody to do something that they can't do. But that happens in adult relationships, too, in friendships, too. Many times we want something from somebody else that they can't give. You know, I don't always know what that is, and it varies between people. But there are expectations that we can have for other people that they cannot meet. And we have to be careful about that. We might want it to be a certain way. We might want someone to be 105 pounds with an hourglass figure, but they may not be capable of that. We may want somebody to be a college graduate or a person who is focused on foreign affairs, and they may not be interested in that. They may not be capable of that. That might not be part of where their gifts lie, and we really have to be aware, I think, of those expectations. Okay, so I didn't get that last one up there. I don't quite know how to say that well, but expectations that ask for what can't be given. Not for what won't be given or for what someone wants doesn't want to give, but for what they can't give, really can't. Again, I think I said last night, I hate to use the word can't, because can't often means, when we say it, when we say I can't do that, it often means I don't want to do that. I won't do it. But there are things that are impossible for us to do. It was impossible for Laura to act like an adult at 10 years of age. And there are other situations like that, too.
Could that impossibility also be because of our attitude right at that time? Attitude toward things or attitude toward ourselves. And so we truly can't do it.
Yeah, it reminds me of responding to God. There are times when we can't do it, and we're not ready to do that, I think. Or I know that that was the case in my own life, and the more someone would have tried and did try to get me to respond, the more I couldn't do it. On the other hand, we can and do learn and grow, and there are times when maybe we would be capable of doing
it. How can we value them where they can't and won't teach?
How can we value them?
Yeah, where at they can't. Maybe sometimes we can see they can't, but sometimes they won't. And how do we see that? Is that just subjective and need to get farther back to take a farther back look?
Well, yeah, it's a good question,
I
think.
I'm doing teenage, like
It's a good question. It's a good question, but a very difficult one to answer, obviously, because what is that line between what somebody can't do and what people won't do? Just like this business of faith, people would have looked at me 15 years ago and said, you could do it if you wanted to. And yet I didn't want to, obviously, in whatever fashion that was. And so from somebody else's perspective, maybe my mother's at the time, she would have wanted that and could have seen that I could do it. But from my perspective, I couldn't do it. And that's what's going on with teens a lot too. So I don't know that there's a good way to say how to draw that line. But I would say this, I think the key is to try to stay away from, again, our agenda, always our agenda and what we want and what we expect, because again, that comes on as I know what's best for you. And yes, we do sometimes know what's best for people who are younger than we are, our children, our spouses. That's a joke. but it depends on how you communicate it. You know, it depends on what you say and how you do that. If you come across as, unfortunately, Jimmy Pearsall's father did, you do it. You can do it. And he did do it, but he paid a terrible price for it.
And within the world we have today, too, the values that we have as a family, how much expectation do you put there? Then do you draw lines and say that's a family value, not to cross as a teenager?
Yeah.
Is that poor communication?
Well, there's a difference, though, between values and expectations. Mm-hmm. Expectations center around action and attitudes. Values run deeper. They certainly are connected with expectations, but you can have a value in your family that says a belief in God and in Jesus Christ is a part of our family without having an expectation that somebody do it your way or be your way. You can still promote that value, but it does, you don't have to require. And many times when we force requirement, when we do the prisoner and the jailer and the prisoner mentality, we get superficial cooperation, but we don't get total commitment. What happened with, Jimmy Pearsall's situation and his father? His father got the behavior and lost the man, the person there. And so there's that real tricky, sensitive relationship between the two.
And also, something to add to that, you have to check out, are you living vicariously through your children? Is it something that you want for yourself? And I think for myself, that something that helped me with my children in terms of having realistic expectations for them was not having amnesia of those teen years. And that has been helpful to me. What was it like being that age, and what did I want from my parents?
Maybe at this point, Pat, we should send out these other ideas. We had a couple other things we wanted to discuss, kind of just go through them quickly. We've got a list of irrational ideas concerning relationships between people. One of the more predominant areas of psychology and counseling these days is called cognitive psychology, and it focuses on the way in which our thinking gets us into difficulty. And one of the cognitive psychologists who's fairly well known is a fellow by the name of Albert Ellis. Ellis is a very strange individual, but he has some good ideas, I think. And we took a list of Ellis's 12 irrational ideas and just kind of played with it a little bit and tried to look at how those might apply to relationships. And so this is kind of an adaptation of some of his irrational ideas. With credit to him for the basic list and with changing them around to fit relationships. And we added a couple. Yeah?
I've got an expectation that those of us in the back row might get a hold of one of these.
Okay. If you're a couple, just take one.
Share.
Yeah. And so if you could just share them. We've only got about 30. Here's one more.
Right.
And if you're not interested, or if you're sleeping, just pass it on to somebody else. Yeah. We'd like to, Pat and I, just kind of like to dialogue with these for a few minutes, just go back and forth with them and talk about them a little bit. And then we want to definitely, and we will save time for you to kind of give some of your ideas. So we'll try to go through quickly. And as you look at these, as you listen to us, certainly note anything that you would disagree with, but also think about what other kinds of irrational ideas might exist that get in the way of relationships or in areas that you've had trouble.
Or circle the ones that you are relating to or identifying with. The first one is the idea that it is necessary and possible that an individual be loved by everyone for everything he or she does. That's irrational because it's impossible. It's impossible that everyone should like you, and it's impossible to believe that someone's going to like you for everything you do all the time. An example of one of the young people that I had counseled, those 27-year-old gal who came in for counseling because she tried to do this. She tried to please everybody. This was a 27-year-old girl that looked like she was 45, trying to please and make everybody happy. I had never seen her smile during the time that I was counseling her for the beginning of the sessions. I never seen her have any life to her eyes. She was so busy doing. She was like the Martha in the Bible, the one who was doing and doing and doing and doing and never getting any gratification. And there's a whole story of, I won't go into how she got there and why she got there. She didn't get a lot of approval for what she was doing. It was based on all things, outward things from her parents, basically. It was an external locus of control, what we call in psychology and in counseling, where her definition herself was defined by outward things, out people, never from internally, developing that self and that internal locus of control of who she is. So got her into a lot of trouble. It's impossible to have everyone love you, and she really worked hard at a losing battle.
Number two, the idea that a person should control a relationship, and it's horrible if one does not have that control. I'm a big control person that I constantly have to kind of look at, and one of the ways I know that is that I can't sleep until my kids come home. I don't know if anybody else has that problem, but it's very difficult for they're not around. I heard a guy, though, say something that really made sense to me. You know, I worry about a lot of things, and he had raised four kids who happened to be a psychiatrist, and he says, you know, Joe, he said, I'm at a point where I'm just thankful that they're alive. And if you have teenagers in your home, you know, sometimes that's where you have to get to. There's only so much control you have, and you can't run somebody else's life and protect them and keep them under wraps all the time.
The third one, the idea that if one worked hard enough at it or made the best possible choice of partners or friends, that one could have a perfect relationship. That again is the ideal notion of a relationship. I didn't know everything about Joe when I married him, and I'm still learning about him. And there is no such thing as a perfect relationship. I think we think that we can find the perfect person, but there is no perfect. The closest thing in terms of a perfect relationship that I know is my relationship with God.
Number four, the idea that one needs another person, stronger or greater than oneself, on whom to rely. We're talking about person here, not God, because both Pat and I would feel very much that we do need to look to a divine creator called our Lord, greater than ourselves. But when we get into the business of looking for somebody else to be in charge of us, somebody else who we can rely on, we set ourselves up for lots of disappointment and disillusionment because people fail us. And it puts us in, of course, a very dependent kind of position in the situation, which doesn't help us to grow very much. But it also puts a terrible strain on that other person. You know what it's like to be in a relationship where you have to be the strong one all the time, where you have to take care of and do for and never experience difficulty? Pretty heavy load.
The fifth one, the idea that in a relationship, one can or should be primarily responsible for the happiness of another. I maintain that you can make no other person happy. The only person that you're responsible and can make happy is yourself. And by making yourself happy, you will inadvertently make others happy.
Number six, the idea the relationship is only a good one when two people spend all their time together. Time together is important for relationships, not just marriages, but friends. So we build relationship by spending time together. On the other hand, we need time apart too. We need separation. We need to refocus on a relationship. I love to go fishing. Some of the best times for me are to go for 3 or 4 days with a couple of high school buddies that I grew up with and go fishing. But you know what? After I'm with those guys for 3 or 4 days, I think, why do I want to be with these guys? I want to go home and be with my wife and family. And I need that experience. And I need that refocusing that says, hey, this isn't so great out here. These guys smell, you know, they argue, they hassle me about stuff that nobody bothers me about at home. And of course, lots of other reasons too, but it helps us to, I think, to refocus on our own relationship.
The seventh one is the idea that in some point in a relationship, one no longer has to work at cultivating that relationship. Relationships require give and take and nurturing. I'm into preventative counseling. I recommend premarital counseling for young couples, and I also recommend periodical checkups.
The idea that if one person in a relationship tells the other person to go to hell, that they have a lousy relationship. This is a kind of a blunt way of saying it's okay to experience anger, it's okay to express anger. Maybe the best way to express anger is not to tell someone to go to hell. On the other hand, so many times I think we forget about the fact that one of the things that builds intimacy is an open expression of feeling. And sometimes those feelings get pretty strong, and sometimes those feelings get pretty upsetting. They aren't going to destroy the relationship if the core relationship is based in working together and building relationship rather than tearing down.
Number 9, the idea that there are innate behavioral and attitudinal differences between men and women that cause most male-female relationship problems. Most problems are caused not by our biological differences, but by our attitudes and feelings and learned behavior.
The idea, number 10, the idea that all feelings of loneliness and happiness will be cured by a successful relationship. I know we spell loneliness wrong here. As you can see in a lot of these, the key words are all, most, perfect, that kind of business. Certainly, relationship, friendship, parent-child relationships, marriage, is a great antidote for loneliness, but it is not a complete antidote. There are many people, and many of us who experience feelings and experiences of loneliness, even in the midst of others, even in the midst of good relationships. I think it's important that we not, again, expect every need to be taken care of every time.
11 and 12 are pretty similar, so I'm going to read them together. The idea that a relationship can grow without sharing between partners, and 12, the idea that we can have an intimate relationship with another person without revealing our fears, vulnerabilities, and weaknesses. Same sex or opposite, you have to risk.
The idea that a relationship once hurt can never be healed. Relationships can be hurt very deeply and very severely by the attitudes and behavior and actions of the people in the relationship. However, if I've learned one thing, and I think Pat would second this in working with other people, that you'd be surprised how we can heal out of brokenness. Perhaps you wouldn't be surprised, perhaps that's happened to you. It's painful, it's difficult, but healing does occur, and change can happen between and within people.
And the last one, the idea that a healthy relationship exists when one person is usually giving and the other person is usually taking, listening, talking, acting and reacting. Balance seems to be the key, and there has to be a give and take. I think you have to remember too, in terms of a give and take level, that is kind of unique to the couple themselves or the person that you're relating with, and that's going to vary from person to person.
Okay, we just wanted to throw these out to you and get some feedback now. like to kind of start to see if you have any irrational ideas, but certainly if you would challenge any of these or if you would disagree. For those of you who were here last night, remember we're often all right. And so what are your thoughts or feelings? We've got about 15 or 20 minutes just to talk about some of this. Any reactions? Any thoughts?
Yeah. Last night when we talked about selfishness, you know, as inhibiting good relationships, I like the way that the thought that number five brings out that that has to stay outside that selfishness accusation. If you are the only person who can make you happy, then sometimes you have to do things that other people might call selfish. In other words, the women's movement has been a lot about that. And so that anyone who is against a woman doing what she needs to do to be a full person could use that selfishness argument. So I'm glad that you have also pointed this out today.
Well, you know, there's no question that there's a balance that's important here. In a relationship, you've got this unique situation where each person is an individual and has needs, individual and personal needs, and yet the relationship has needs too. And the challenge for us in relationships, it seems to me, and in community, is, which is just relationship expanded, is how can we strike a balance between meeting the needs that we have and yet ministering to others, and compromising often with others. If we don't have those qualities and if we don't have that kind of dynamic balance between individual and other needs, we're going to have trouble probably in relationship or in community. But there's no perfect balance. It's an ongoing dynamic change. Some people work out that balance by compromising a lot on everything. Other people work out that balance by trading off. You know, and you got your way last time. It's my turn to make that decision. We've lived in this place. I know many people, not many, some who kind of decide that where things are going to go and what's going to happen on a 5-year basis. This is my 5 years, you know, and so there are lots of ways to do it, but it does require that kind of struggle for balance. Other thoughts?
Conversely, about this not being able to look to somebody else for your happiness, you also can't blame them for your unhappiness.
Right.
And that's a little bit tougher, mm-hmm. because we don't really believe that we're unhappy because we make ourselves unhappy. Try to teach that to kids. Yeah. It's mm-hmm. an interesting process.
Mm-hmm. Albert Ellis says that blame is at, he maintains that blame is at the core of most emotional disturbances, mm-hmm. either outside blame or self-blame.
Blaming others or blaming
yourself.
Fourth graders, I start out, and I'll say, well, why did you do this? And I say, well, my mother. And I'll say, well, wait a minute. Or they start pointing. Yeah. We don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And that's really difficult.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What did you say about Albert Ellis saying about blame and this?
Blame is at the core of most emotional disturbances. It's just one way of thinking of how emotional disturbances are caused.
Since my husband and I moved out here, out west to Oregon, we've been much closer to my sister and her husband. And when we spend time together, as husband and wife, and husband and wife, we both come to the same conclusion, we sisters. We're glad we're married to the ones we're married to and not to the other ones. We've got no adjustments.
Isn't that a fortunate experience, though?
Yeah.
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 There seems to be an equally sort of absurd idea brought among those of us who are getting on towards the midlife crisis, or one of several, that at a certain point, a relationship will mature into perfection, and that if it doesn't, by whatever year 25, we're in ditch. You know?
Yeah.
And that because our relationship isn't perfect after
that's been a few years, it's not worthwhile.
The idea that if you've been working at it hard for 25 years, it should show some fruits. Instead of just having to go out to work every day.
Or I think there is also often the idea that I'm going, in a marriage, that I'm going to learn to understand the other person completely. Or even the idea that I do understand the other person completely. And then there's a complete shock when that person is unpredictable. And I found that as I've gotten older, I'm willing to say things that I didn't say before. And but then I found out my husband does the same thing too. So we do change.
Yeah, that's the other side of it too. I think what you were saying in, at the latter part of your statement there, and that is that not only do we get more bold maybe about or learn how to say things, but we do change as we go along. And that's what makes marriage and friendships so dynamic and so difficult, that there's this constant, you know, one person is moving along here and they got to kind of reach back and pull this person along, and then the other person moves out here and you got to reach back and pull them in. And there's that kind of ongoing dynamic quality that, that continually opens up new challenges to the relationship. And that's where, of course, too, and it, I know it's trite, but that's where if you're not talking to one another or involved, in a sense, with this other person in the relationship, you don't know where they're at enough. And if they get too far out there and too far down the road, there are many problems. One of the things that happens in counseling, for example, if one person in a relationship comes in and you can't get the other person in, one of the raps on counseling and psychotherapy is it breaks up marriages. Well, one of the reasons that happens is because if you don't get two people in there together, often one person is growing in lots of ways, learning, becoming more aware, wanting something different, and if you don't have that person kind of pulled along with it, then you get this real wide discrepancy, and then many times that breaks the bond.
I'd like to have you say a little bit more about number three. You know, thinking about that from hindsight for those of us who have been married for a while, and also thinking about it from having marriage-age children and seeing them making their choices of mates, that idea of the best possible choice, having a better relationship. This is an irrational idea, supposedly.
Well, I think the irrationality, there's no question that working at a relationship is important. Although, it's interesting, I was just looking at Lazarus's book, and he talked about the fact that he doesn't like the word work. You know, that sounds like kind of drudgery, that that there are other ways to talk about what has to happen in a relationship besides saying working at it. But in my opinion, there's no question that working at it is important. There's no question, too, that a that one could make a good choice and a bad choice for a friend or for a life partner. But I think the irrational part here is that that somehow those things can make a perfect relationship. That if we do that, if we make the best choice and if we work at it, then we will have this kind of perfect relationship. And the key word is perfect. It's not going to be perfect. That the best choice of partners is still going to require a tremendous amount of compromise and communication and sharing and acceptance. But no question, you know, there you can make good and bad choices too, and there may be an amount of work that could never overcome a very poor choice of relationship. Does that speak to what you're getting at?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe if they'd substituted the word better relationship, it would have been not an irrational idea.
Okay, don't say they, say you, because we did this. If we had substituted, which word now?
No, it stands
you know, you put it correctly.
Uh-huh.
It's probably true that it would be a better relationship if you could choose a good partner and could work at it.
No.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that would be irrational.
Right.
Yeah. I think
there's one hand in the back.
Yeah. I was just going to comment on number 10. I think that cracking that myth is probably the most liberating thing for me in perceiving a relationship on both sides. The idea that all loneliness and unhappiness can be cured in a good relationship, because I think there's that magical thinking that, you know, this existential aloneness that we all have to come to terms with in life, that, you know, it's really me and God in this world, and there are some parts of me that will just never be understood by another human being. And to magically think that a relationship will fix that and be on a quest for someone that's going to understand that,
mm-hmm.
you know, is chasing rainbows, I mm-hmm. think. And I think not only does it liberate it, but it's okay if I never find that person to share that with, although it would be nice. But there are people from whom life will always be very lonely, and I can never fix that.
Mm-hmm.
And when I can start accepting other people as having parts of their lives as being so lonely that nothing can touch it, I don't anymore feel responsible for getting in and trying to fix that part. And I think that's something more of us need to understand earlier. It took me a long time to get there.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you.
Mm-hmm. I think that perhaps that what she's done is put another myth, that you have to have a relationship with someone else to be a complete person.
Yeah.
I think you've got to be able to stand on your own
mm-hmm.
and then choose to join with someone else,
mm-hmm.
not so that they can support you, but
mm-hmm.
that you are dependent upon them for your growth.
Yes, the far better relationships are based on two people who have some definition of self and who come together, rather than, again, this unrealistic expectation that we will be defined through the relationship. And this really was the plight of women earlier. In many ways, that the definition so often for so many women came through their marriage and their relationship. And many women were terribly unhappy prior to... many women are still terribly unhappy, and many men are also. But what the women's movement was trying to look at here was, what about you? What about yourself? Who are you? Not who are you necessarily defined in terms of your marriage or your family, but who are you as a person? And of course that created some problems too, in that sometimes it was taken to the extreme, and then there was a tremendous rejection of sometimes family or relationship. But it's true that we have to establish, in a sense, who we are, not by the expectations of what somebody else will do for us, but by our own struggle with self.
One other part of that is there's something very freeing about giving yourself permission to have a time of loneliness and feeling supported by the people around you who will let you be there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You know, mm-hmm. being able to recognize that place when you say, this is a really painfully lonely afternoon for me, and that's all right with me. Let me be there. And everybody doesn't rush to fix that, you know. It just loves you right where you are.
Mm-hmm.
And it passes, you know. But it only passes because you let it happen.
I have a statement that I say, sometimes I have to go to the desert with God. And you have to be lonely. You have to struggle with some of the issues yourself. And you've got to permit ourselves to do that.
But people don't want to let you do that. You know, I lost a good friend a few weeks ago who had been struggling with cancer for 4 years, and I've been with her through an awful lot of that. And, you know, there's just a lot of pain that goes in letting go of that relationship. And there's nobody in the world that could take her place or could fix that. People that really cared were the ones that just said, yeah, that really hurts. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's really okay. Cry it out. Do it. And I think that we need to understand that about each other better, because we go around trying to fix problems for each other that we can't do.
We also have a responsibility of telling people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think sometimes we want people to read our minds. I know I did that with Joe. You know, I thought he was a psychologist, supposed to know everything. You know, my expectation was, I mean, you know what I'm feeling. You know, you deal with people, you know what I'm feeling. But we need to tell, and we need to state what we need. And I think sometimes women get, and I know it's our sex, and men too. Women are not the only ones that are guilty, but I know women more often than men don't tell where they're at. You know. We don't go direct from A to B. We hem and haw about it, and we're pouting, slamming doors, and we need 3 days away. We need to go to the desert.
I didn't know that.
That would be very much number 15. You should know what I'm feeling.
Yeah.
And you should
that's
know
good.
What I need.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You should provide
right.
those.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, when you think, if you start thinking about it, there are lots of those kinds of irrational ideas. And that you're right, that's one. You should know what I feel. If you really love me,
yeah.
You should know what I'm feeling and what I need without my telling you.
Oh, that's more sensitivity than most people have.
Exactly
yeah,
right,
exactly.
And again, if you reverse it, if you think about the fact that you would have to do that with somebody, you'd see how foolish that would be.
Yeah.
You know? And when we think about, do I know where you folks are? If it weren't having coffee, do I really know your hidden hurts? I don't, yeah.
It's kind of an insult, too, in a way, when you think about it, to think that another person can read your mind or wants to read your mind, really, to be honest.
But I like your comment, too, and that is sometimes we stop, we want to do that or we try to do it, maybe we've done it, but we stop doing it because we've done it and people don't. Here, even when I tell
so
you
have to
what I need,
to
yeah.
accept that they might not know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or that they can't,
they
or
can.
That they haven't
mm-hmm.
learned how. Other thoughts? Yeah, one or just a few minutes left.
I was thinking of the relationship between the two couples, my sister, her husband, and my husband, and myself. She's been married, and she's always been home. She's been home. While we were married, 25 years ago, so they're married more than 50 years ago. I had worked for a long time, and both husbands are identical. They came from the same mold, old fashioned. Me, the boss, you do this, and all that. And her reaction has been to just go inward. She doesn't respond. She's very quiet. She never tells her feelings to anyone. She talks a lot, but it's very surface. Well, I'm just gabbing. I don't take nothing from nobody, and I tell him everything that he says to me. I'm going to give it right back to him. Neither one of our relationships are real good. That's what I came to this class for. What can I do to improve our relationship? But I don't want to sit there and swallow everything either.
I think it's important that you do say what you feel. I think that's probably, maybe you might not be heard, but at least keep on trying to say what you need and what you feel at the time.
But learning how to say it, too, is
I'm
important.
I'm not saying it right.
Yeah.
It's attacking,
and,
yeah.
I'm not promising you a complete answer, but tomorrow and Thursday and Friday, we're going to try to talk about, last night we talked about why relationships are broken. We're kind of continuing with how expectations get in the way of relationships, but there's going to be a shift, and we're going to try to work in the latter part of the week with some ways in which we can try to improve or heal the relationship. So I hope that will be of help to you, but as I said, do the best we can. Yeah.
I've tried to put into a picture what a marriage relationship is like. And years ago, one of our sons got a rock polisher. And we got that rock polisher going, and you put some rocks in there down the basement. You could hear that rock polisher going night and day. And it just made a terrible racket. But eventually it turned out some nice gems.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I guess marriage is kind of like a rock polisher.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Make a terrible racket. But hopefully we turn out some gems.
Oh, that's neat.
And hopefully you don't throw those stones at one another.
Hopefully
you
stay in rock polisher long enough to get smooth.
Yeah, nice analogy. Yeah. And I have another one that's from a fellow that we'll share in the latter session. It has much the same thing. Well, very good. Thanks for your coming and participation. We'll see you later.